Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And I hope that you're enjoying our new format with a singular theme that we're focusing on for each episode. Today's topic is a deep one. We're going to be learning about the flood.
I see what you did there.
Yep. Mm-hmm. For the podcast listeners, we did finger guns on that that terrible dad joke. We're going to be focusing, though, on the flood and whether it was global or local.
That's right. Topic comes up quite a bit. A lot of people are very interested in that. I think we should start off by clarifying, though, this is not a salvation issue. Like this, you're getting kind of into the details of biblical beliefs and the geological stuff. So, yeah, we definitely want to have an open mind in this episode.
Right. Definitely. Let's just like listen to it and understand that it's not a salvific issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in Everyday Apologetics, we're going to hear from biochemist Fuzzel Rana on the scientific evidence for mass human extinction.
And in Jeff's segment, we're going to be hearing from astrophysicist Hugh Ross, and they're going to discuss if water covered the entire Earth. So it's really interesting how they make that distinction when we're talking about a flood.
That's right. Yeah. First up is Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be speaking with philosopher George Harrakson, and they're going to talk about happy little rainbows and if they existed before the flood. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with ethics professor George Harrakson. You're also a scholar here at Reasons to Believe. And you know what? If one thing that people say about me is I'm so colorful, I love rainbows and all things bright and, you know, vivid. And we're talking today, not about that, but we're talking about...
We're not talking about your vividness.
Yes, no, we're talking about Noah's flood and the rainbow is a, you know, a key part of that. And, you know, it's just, it's something that I'm fascinated by because of all the fun colors. So let's talk about rainbows.
Yeah. Well, it's a key symbol, obviously. Yes. I would remember when we were going to talk about this, when we were about to have our first child, we were choosing, you know, to set up the room and all, have the crib. And we chose a Noah's Ark theme, but we didn't know what we were having, a baby boy or girl. So we had to choose some sort of, you know, neutral colors, as it were. And I remember choosing the Noah's Ark theme, not so much because of my religious background, let's say, but it looked cool. I just, I liked it, but it had the rainbow in it. And then I thought, I was just starting off as being a pastor. And then I thought much later, I'm like, what an odd combination. Here's the story of the rescue of these people. And I'm celebrating this with my baby boy, but think about God's judgment on all the depraved people.
Right.
You know, I think one author said, we don't really share that part of it when we're talking, sharing the story with kids or the account with kids, but as adults, we should face up to it.
Right, well, let's face up to it. I mean, let's talk about the text and what it's unpacking.
Yeah, well, the text there, it reads in Genesis 9 that it is a symbol of God's covenant with us.
Right.
That is, the judgment that was placed upon the depravity of humankind at that time, that particular judgment would be no more, and the rainbow was a symbol for that. And there's a couple of different kinds of meanings that we can talk about when it comes to that.
Well, let's talk about what that means, this covenant and that symbol of the rainbow. What did it represent for Noah?
Yeah, I think, and also for the readers, the people who would read the narrative. One thing, you can obviously take a poetic or a, there's an emotional meaning that comes from it. After a storm, what do we see?
Yeah, rainbow.
You know, the rainbow, and sort of know how bad the storm is. When it's over, there's kind of that release. You see the rainbow, you see the beauty that comes after it. And, you know, there's a part, a sense of that, there's a maybe a somewhat of a clean slate that humanity's starting with Noah's family. But they have a job ahead of them, and that's to be good.
Yeah. Well, and then surely there's beyond the poetic meaning, there's also some theological implications there with the rainbow. So what are those implications?
I think one of them that's interesting and that I hadn't known for a long time that the word, sometimes you see it, the word translated rainbow, it shouldn't be translated rainbow. It means specifically bow, like as in bow and arrow.
Okay.
And you could reflect on that a little bit, and what would the readers or the hearers hear in that story? Well, they would think of a bow and arrow. Mm-hmm. And you might think of it this way, that God's judgment, like a bow, was placed upon the depravity of humanity. Mm-hmm. But now when we see the rainbow, which way is it facing? It's facing a different way. Mm-hmm. God is no longer going to use that, at least he says in the text, that specific judgment to judge humanity. He's going to deal with humanity in a different way. And ultimately, that's going to end up with Christ and his death on the cross and then his resurrection. God places his wrath, his justice upon Jesus. And then that is, Jesus pays that debt. And then we have the opportunity to be adopted into his family.
Yeah. Well, I know you're not a scientist, so you can't unpack this next question fully, but I'm curious because I've heard people ask this question of whether the rainbow that was given as a symbol of the covenant made with Noah, that was the first time a rainbow ever appeared. And in my mind, I'm like, scientifically, that doesn't make sense that it would be the first time, but how would you address that question?
Well, as a pastor, when we're walking through different books of the Bible, obviously walking through Genesis, you have to encounter those issues in the text. Dr. Hugh Ross, here at Reasons to Believe, has gone through this in navigating Genesis. I think it's on, if I remember correctly, it's on like in the 90s, page 96 or so. And
that's
I just remember because I was reading it. But he talks about how we don't have, there's neither geological evidence nor necessarily biblical evidence that that's the first rainbow. So I don't think we're expected to hold to that view. There likely, well, geologically, I think it does show that there had been rain and likely rainbows prior to that. Obviously, we don't have an imprint of rainbows in the fossil record. But even in the text, there's no reason to think that we have to think that. Sometimes people confuse the two words when it talks about the water coming up from the ground. There's a distinction between rain and then streams bubbling up. And so there's good reason to think that if the flood did have those streams also coming up, that doesn't mean that there wasn't any rain before that time. Although some people have propounded a model like that. So that's where
that there wasn't any rain.
That there wasn't any rain before that. All the water came from aquifers or something from the ground.
Interesting.
But I don't think we have to believe that from the text. The text doesn't necessarily teach that, and the geological record doesn't seem to indicate that.
So it's not a salvation issue. It's just something that, you know, because I am curious. I think if rainbows didn't exist before that Noah and his family were probably screaming, seeing like these colors in the sky. Like all of a sudden you see this phenomenon that has never existed before. I think that'd be a little terrifying.
It could be. Although the rainbow is quite beautiful, you have to say.
No, for sure it is. But just out of nowhere, I'd be like, what is this? So, you know, I think it's really just a fascinating topic. And there's so much more to say about the flood. Of course, we're talking about where the waters came from, whether it was local or global. So we're going to get into that in the other segments, but I really appreciate your thoughts just on kind of explaining the symbolism and behind rainbows and how it relates to the flood. So thank you so much for that, George. If you would like to learn more about this topic, you can check out Dr. Hugh Ross's book, Navigating Genesis, available at shop.reasons.org. And for more from George Harrackson, go to reasons.org and search George Harrackson.
Yes, in your book, Who Was Adam, you mentioned that due to the flood, the common male ancestor for humanity would in fact be Noah, not Adam, because of the extinction, while the common female ancestor would, of course, be Eve. And you cite some genetic evidence to support that. My question is there any additional evidence that would indicate that there was a mass extinction of humanity followed by a reemergence, such as archaeological or geological evidence?
Yeah, great question. And just so that everybody here is tracking with you, and this is something I didn't bring up in the talk because it can become a somewhat of a complex point, but when scientists date the origin of the male lineage using the Y chromosomal data, they typically arrive at a more recent date than they get for the dating of the maternal lineage using mitochondrial DNA. So there, you know, in the scientific literature, there's this question: did Adam and Eve know each other, and not only in the biblical sense, but also literally, did they know each other because of this difference in time? And so this is a great, really a great enigma within the evolutionary camp, how do you account for this? And one possibility is that that difference may actually be an artifact of the methods that you're using, that they're not identical methods, that they're very similar, and some of that difference could just simply be methodological in nature. And there's actually some evidence to indicate that. But some recent work actually shows that there is no matter what study you look at, there always seems to be this constant difference between mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam. One possibility is, as you alluded to, the Y chromosomal data is going back to Noah and his sons, which would have had the same Y chromosome, and the mitochondrial data is going back closer towards Eve. There's a team from the University of Arizona that took another approach where they said, what if we assumed that Adam and Eve existed at the same time? What does that data tell us about effective population sizes? And they basically concluded that there was a four times greater population of women versus men. Well, that also is consistent with a flood account, because you'd have Noah and his sons, again, having one Y chromosome, but there would be Noah's wife and the three wives of the sons, which may very well have each had different mitochondrial DNA sequences that would give this appearance of different effective population sizes. So we're suggesting that maybe that discrepancy is actually pointing to some kind of flood event and is indirect evidence that there indeed was this type of flood event. Now, in terms of the archaeological evidence and the fossil evidence, you really see very little in the fossil record and the archaeological record between about 80,000 years ago and 40,000 years ago. And it's after that time where you begin to see an explosion of human remains. And those remains are basically in Europe and Asia, Africa, and Australia, and the archaeological evidence is in those regions as well. So it looks as if there was this very rapid migration at about the same time, which we would say would have reflected the migration after the flood. But there's very little prior to that, and maybe it's simply reflecting very low population sizes. So I don't know that I necessarily answered your question, but that's one of the frustrations in dealing with anthropology, is that the data sometimes is remarkably scant, and nobody has data to work with, so you're trying to put together a puzzle with only a few pieces in many instances.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here, and welcome to the segment of 2819, where we get to take a deeper dive into the scholarly literature. And today we're going to talk about the flood. What are the scientific evidences for it? How as Christians do we think about that? Joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Hugh Ross. So let's get started. Hugh, as Christians talk about the flood, everybody agrees there was a flood of some sort.
Talk about Noah's flood, right?
We're talking about Noah's flood, yes. There's a discussion of whether the flood covered the entire earth and what sort of physical implications did that have. So before we start, just give us a brief description of what RTB's position is on the flood. And we're talking about 30 seconds here. So.
Okay, 2 Peter 2:5, the world of ungodly people was wiped out by the flood. So it's the entire extent of Earth's surface where human beings were living. Not the whole globe, just that part of the earth where humans, ungodly humans, and the animals bonded to them were living.
Okay, so we're talking, so that in that there's this critical part of that model is that humanity had not extended to cover the whole earth, because if that was the case, then the flood will be global, correct?
Right.
But so we're some smaller region than the entire earth, but the flood extended to that whole region where humanity and everything that it impacted was wiped out.
Every human and all their animals were wiped out except for those on board the ark.
Okay, so one question that would come up in that, what sort of extent are we talking about there?
Well, I believe the flood happened during the last ice age.
Okay.
That's because of how long the biblical text tells us that the water receded, which means there had to be a huge amount of melting snow and ice to explain why it took a whole year for the waters to recede.
Okay, so just before we move on there, flesh that out a little bit.
know, Bible says it takes on the order of a year for the floodwaters to recede. Why does that require an ice age to make that happen?
Well, the longest flood we know of in recent times was the Mississippi Valley about a quarter of a century ago.
Okay.
Where it was flooded for 4 months, 50 feet deep, the Mississippi Valley. But that was a year when we had a huge amount of snow melt off of the Canadian and American Rockies. And so the water that was flowing out into the Gulf of Mexico was being replaced by fresh water from snow melt. Well, likewise, the water that'd be flowing out of the Middle Eastern region into the Indian Ocean, that was being replaced by the melting of snow and ice in the mountainous and hill regions around that. But it's also a time when the sea level was 300 or 400 below what it is right now. So it changes the geography of the flood. Mm-hmm. It's much more than just the Mesopotamian plain. That would be a time when the Persian Gulf was dry land. So the Persian Gulf is flooded, the Mesopotamian plain is flooded, large chunks of what are now Iran and Saudi Arabia would have been flooded. It's really quite a large flood, and explains why, given the geography that existed in the days of the last ice age, you could have a flood extensive enough that it wipes out all of humanity.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about a flood that extensive, I mean, one thing that is true is the higher the water level, the faster it runs out. So to flood that entire region, you got to be pretty high in elevation. I mean, you got to have a fairly deep flood to cover all of that region. Well, so the waters have to be pretty high. So they're going to be flowing out pretty quickly. How do you take a year to drain that?
Well, again, what we see during the last ice age, there are episodes, short episodes of dramatic warming. Even though ice was there, there'd be periods when it'd be, you know, literally thousands of feet thickness of ice would be melting mm-hmm. in a short period of time. So when you got that quantity of ice being melted that fast, yes, even with a flood that's say 400 feet deep, you can replace the water that's flowing out into the ocean.
Okay, and so this is kind of an interesting way to look at it, because effectively what you're saying is that the length of time described in the Bible actually provides us input in how to go look at the conditions that are going around, the conditions are going on. Why could this not just be a global flood where it takes a year and a half for the waters to settle back into the underground aquifers? What keeps that explanation from being a good one?
Well, we have no geological evidence for a flood that big. I mean, if the flood was global, and basically the global flood people believe in a global flood, they have to find some way to change the geology where you don't have as much relief, and the relief pops up during the receding.
So just to make sure, relief is mountains and valleys. You're talking about texture to the surface
of
the earth.
Well, like right now, we got 70,000 feet of difference in height and depth, if you mm-hmm. include the oceans and the highest mountains. And in order to have a global flood, you need to have that a lot less, which also means that with the receding of the waters, all that vertical tectonic movement needs to happen. And the global flood models I've also looked at basically have a supercontinent that splits up during the 1 year. The problem with all those models, it's way too much tectonic activity to squeeze into a 5 month period. And if you actually look at the energy release from all the tectonics you would need to have a global flood, it's enough to evaporate all the water in the face of the earth. And clearly the text doesn't permit that.
Well, okay, so let's investigate that claim for just a second. Because so what you're saying is in a global flood model, typically all the continents are in one place and the mountains and valleys are much less because there's just a limited quantity of water here on the earth. And to be able to cover it, that's the constraint you have. So you're saying that in order to get from that situation to something that akin to what we see today, where there are, you know, 30,000 foot mountains, big troughs, all that sort of stuff, to do that, the tectonic activity would vaporize all the water on the earth. Kind of explain how that flows out, because it just seems like tectonic activity means things are moving across the surface of the earth.
Well, I mean, you and I have been through tectonic plate movements where you get 2 inches of movement, and, you know, it's quite destructive. I remember one such earthquake that damaged all of our furniture, and it was only 2 inches of plate tectonic movement. Multiply that up to 5,000 miles of plate tectonic movement. That's horizontal movement. And you mentioned 70,000 feet of vertical movement. I mean, we're not just talking magnitude 9 earthquakes.
Okay, so it's not, I mean, you know, instead of just getting sounds, just the physical movement is going to generate a lot of kinetic energy in the earth, and that's what's going to
vaporize. A lot of kinetic energy. That's what's going to vaporize the water. That's what's going to kill all life on the face of the earth.
So these global flood models have problems in terms of where do you get all the water, how do you get the tectonic relief, how do you not vaporize the oceans while that...
And you've got to get the Arctic to survive. Look at the tsunamis you're going to have.
That's a fair point. There are some challenges with those.
Right.
So let's kind of... So we... RTB has a local flood model, and I hesitate to use that because most people...
I prefer the word universal.
I got that, because there's this distinction. It's a local flood, but it's a very large flood. And it extends to all of humanity. And
it wipes out all of humanity except those on
right.
the ark.
So is there scientific evidence for a flood like that?
Well, there is evidence that there's an enormous aquifer underneath the Persian Gulf. And so I believe that probably Noah was building the ark in what's called the Persian Gulf Oasis, which would have been dry land during the last ice age. And the text tells us that water came up from the deep. So something happened tectonically that caused all that water below to come up to the surface. You got torrential rain coming down for 40 days and 40 nights. There's actually some geological evidence of a berm at the Gulf of Hormuz. And if that berm were to break, that would cause a rush of ocean water to come into those regions. And then you got the melting of huge amounts of ice and snow off of the mountains and hills around there. So I see four distinct sources of water, sufficient sources of water, that we could actually conceive of wiping on all of humanity except for those on board the ark, but distributed enough that we would expect the people on board the ark to survive.
Yeah, so there's lots of processes that are going in there, but that's also something unique that you wouldn't expect to happen frequently or very often or maybe even ever again, which points to its miraculous nature as well.
To me, what makes it miraculous, they're happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Yes, these four events could happen independent of one another. The fact that they all happen at the same time and of sufficient magnitude to actually wipe out all of humanity, except for those on board the ark, and ensure that those on board the ark actually survive these four simultaneous events.
Well, that is pretty important. I thank you for your comments, Hugh. You know, Christians do argue quite a bit about whether the flood was global or local and what's the evidence for this, that, and even skeptics look and say, the idea that a flood wiped out all of humanity, that can't happen. But there are ways, when you look carefully at what the text says, when you look at what the scientific data points to, you can build a model where there is this flood that wipes out all of humanity, that causes this catastrophic destruction in a local region, that wipes out all of humanity, and yet recedes in just the way it's talked about, and it also points to the miraculous nature of God using it for his purposes. You know, and so what we find is that as we look at what Scripture says and what creation says, we find that they line up. And that gives us good reason to believe that the God of the Bible is the God who created the universe.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that you learned something new about the flood and can find a way to talk about it with your friends. So
what's
your takeaway today?
I think when we talk about global, local, universal, like those are all distinctions that are very important, where we can say that it was universal, but not covering the entire earth. So it included all of humanity that existed and in the location where they existed. Right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's a good distinction.
Yeah.
I'm still wrapping my head around it, but I just loved all the talk about the geological stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, that's not in my wheelhouse normally, but I'm catching on. But just that there obviously was evidence for rain before, mm-hmm. you know, Noah's flood.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily mean there was evidence for the global flood that we talked about. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in that one.
Especially the rainbow part. I love talking about rainbows.
Yes, that was very fun. I love them in my Lucky Charms.
Yes. Well, you know what? We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And then maybe, what do you think about the flood and rainbows?
If you want the podcast version of our show, we are on most major podcast services. Just search Reason to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.